This episode is brought to you by the Master of Arts in Catholic Education program at the Augustine Institute Graduate School of Theology. Dedicated to the renewal of Catholic education, this degree equips school teachers and administrators to bring Christ to the center of every classroom through a focus on sacred scripture, theology, Christian anthropology, and the traditional liberal arts. Learn more at augustine.edu/MACE. Aaron Wren is with us today. He's a writer, consultant in Indianapolis. He was at the Manhattan Institute, and he now is the author of a new book entitled Life in the Negative World, Confronting Challenges in an Anti-Christian Culture. Welcome, Mr. Wren.
Thanks for having me.
We jump right in here. We'll go to the title. You say we are in a new unprecedented era. This comes from early in the book. A new unprecedented era, one I call the negative world. What is unprecedented? What is different about today? I mean, I know, huge question, but just generally, what is different about today?
America never had a state church like Europe, but we did have a sort of softly institutionalized generic Protestantism as our default national religion for most of our history. I mean, certainly up through the 1950s, when half of all adults attended church every Sunday, we had prayer and Bible reading in school. We were adding "In God We Trust" to our money. And so this was a situation where society didn't always live in accordance with Christian morality or any of that. I'm not saying it did, but Christianity was held in honor, public honor, in the land. And then in the 60s, that started to unravel. And Christianity went into decline. And so I divide the period from 1964 to the present, this period of decline of Christianity, into three phases, what I call the positive, neutral, and negative worlds. So the positive world is 64 to 94. It is a period of decline for Christianity. I want to make that clear. Church attendance is going down. The sexual revolution is happening. Yet it is still basically viewed positively in society. To be known as a good church-going man makes people want to hire you. Christian moral norms are still the basic moral norms of society. Then in 1994, we hit a tipping point and enter what I call the neutral world, which lasted from 94 to 2014, where Christianity is not really seen positive anymore, but it's not really seen negatively yet either. It's essentially one more lifestyle choice in a pluralistic public square, and Christian moral norms have some residual effect. Then in 2014, we hit a second tipping point where, for the first time in the 400-year history of America, essentially official elite culture is now negative or at least skeptical towards Christianity. Being known as a Bible-believing Christian does not help you get a job at Goldman Sachs or Google. Quite the opposite, in fact. Christian morality is now expressly rejected by society and in many ways is now viewed as the leading threat to the new public moral order. And so this really is an unprecedented situation in the country. And I do want to put one nuance on this. Merely identifying as a Christian does not necessarily get you in trouble, but the contents of your Christianity cannot conflict with the, you know, consensus secular ideologies, or you will find yourself in trouble. And so that creates a situation where there is essentially implicit social pressure to bring your beliefs into alignment with essentially secular culture, which in fact we've seen drift kind of in that direction.
Yeah. And in the book, I mean, you've laid out these three phases, and I want to tell people that you actually spend a lot of time talking about each phase. You don't just jump to the present. And when we go to that positive, I mean, there are elements in each phase that you discuss. And if we go back to the positive phase, really, you know, this when the decline began up until then, 1994, Christianity, you acknowledge, was in decline. And Christians did sense the decline during this positive phase, and that we saw efforts by Christians in the 60s and 70s to work somehow tactically within the decline. You give one method that many of them followed. It was the, quote, seeker sensitivity method. Give us an example of what that kind of method was about. What was it trying to handle?
Sure. Well, seeker sensitivity originated in the 1970s with people like Bill Hybels of Willow Creek Church in suburban Chicago, Rick Warren of Saddleback Church in Orange County. And sort of the origin story of Willow Creek is that Bill Hybels went door to door in suburban Chicago asking people why they didn't go to church. And as he said, I got an earful. And so what he did was he designed a church that people would be willing to attend. So his strategy was essentially, let's do some market research. Let's find out why the existing churches are not serving the market well. And then let's design something that will be more consumer friendly, basically. And so Willow Creek was non-denominational. They got rid of all these denominational distinctives. It was informal. It had contemporary music. It had a very, not much of, call it formal liturgies. The sermons are very topical, almost therapeutic. And this really became the suburban non-denominational megachurch that we know today, which in many ways represents the evangelical mainstream. Of course, there's variations in these and, the styles have updated over time. But this was essentially one way to get people in the doors. You know, in the 70s, the mainline denominations had really dominated America, up through the 50s. And as they went into decline, they tried to figure out what was going on, too. In the 1970s, the Lilly Endowment began funding a lot of research about what's going on with the decline in churches, but they were never able to turn it around. They weren't able to come up with a strategy, whereas, Hybels and people like him were able to do that.
I presume that even as they try to show sensitivity, I guess they gave us a softer, more welcoming Christianity, the Jesus of don't judge, as opposed to the Jesus, going into, ransacking the temple. The opposite figures during that positive period, not the seeker sensitivity, but the culture warriors, Jerry Falwell. How successful would you rate Jerry Falwell's methods during those years?
Yeah, so again, evangelicals had originally been Democrats. I don't think a lot of people remember that. Jimmy Carter was the first evangelical president, and Newsweek magazine called 1976 the year of the evangelical because of him. And there was a lot of concern about the time of what it meant for this Bible thumper Jimmy Carter to get in there. Even as late as 1982, a plurality of evangelicals identified as Democrats. But what happened was in the late 70s, really coming out of the broader New Right movement in conservative politics, people like Jerry Falwell and then Pat Robertson they saw what was going on in the culture, and they decided what they were going to do is they were going to mobilize politically to fight back and take back the culture, if you will. And just as the term seeker sensitive assumes a certain latent positivity, it assumes there are a lot of people out there seeking. The very name of his organization, Moral Majority, speaks to a world in which it was at least plausible to claim that Christianity spoke for a majority of the country. Now, it might not have been true even then, but like Nixon's silent majority, it was at least something that was plausible to claim. And I would say, Falwell was obviously enormously successful in many ways. Personally, his church was very successful. Liberty University is, a dynamo, financially in terms of enrollments and other things. I think the culture war strategy didn't really reverse, the trends in the culture. You can say that after, 40 years of it, we had one major victory, which was achieved with a repeal of Roe versus Wade. But that was primarily a result of a legal strategy involving a very narrow appointments to the Supreme Court. And that was mostly, I think, you know, a lot of that. And of course, there was also a Catholic dimension to this. I think the Catholics provided a lot of the thought leadership on this movement. So I don't think that the culture war was particularly successful. I mean, that's what I would say. It certainly produced a lot of energy. There's certainly a lot of people who were, you know, kind of inspired and mobilized by it. But it hasn't really altered the culture or the politics of the country. Now, in fairness, maybe nobody could have stopped that. This is a freight train coming down the tracks. And the idea that there's some just great strategy, you know, out of there. So I would certainly say this has been a strategy that has not been a great success, you know, when you look at it in aggregate.
If you move into the neutral era, 1994, was there any specific event that you would point to in 94?
You know, you could have a big debate. I think the transition from positive to neutral is the one that's the hardest to pin down. You could have picked 1989, which was the fall of the Berlin Wall. I think the collapse of the Soviet Union was a critical event because so long as the Cold War was ongoing, Christianity was part of the moral battle against the atheist materialist Soviet system. Yeah. And it was only after the collapse of Soviet Union that Christianity could be unbundled from that. But there were a couple things that I picked as why I picked 1994.
Well, before you mentioned those two, I think, Aaron, that plausibility of 89, maybe it just took a few years for the collapse really to sink in as a historical impact. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, I think a lot of things were going on in around that era. One is a sort of transition to baby boomer leadership, particularly with Bill Clinton becoming president in 92. 1994 was the Gingrich Revolution, where the Republicans captured the House of Representatives. In my view, that was the high watermark of the religious right in America at that time. And then the other main event was Rudy Giuliani becoming mayor of New York, and the crime collapse in New York, the fact that big cities came back, created a new phenomenon of a sizable new demographic of urban, educated progressives that became a major force in the country, I think, culturally, you know, in the coming decades. You know, back in, you know, in the 1980s, you know, New York was sort of viewed as a kill zone. I mean, the film Escape from New York, it's a future dystopia in which New York City has been turned into a prison. I think that film came out in 1991. Time magazine even did a huge story on the rotting of the Big Apple in the early 90s. And it was like, bam, cities came back. And that was a huge event in the culture as well. So I picked, you know, I really think the Giuliani, Gingrich, and then the transition to boomer leadership really was, I think, a big part of it.
Let's pause for a moment to hear from one of our valued sponsors. Ralston College is an inspiring revival of the traditional university, dedicated to honest and intense study of the humanities. Admissions are now open for its Master's in Arts program in the humanities in 2024-25. The first term is based in Greece, where students will be immersed in ancient and modern Greek, reading Homer, Plato, John's Gospel, and Kavafi. The following three terms will be located in the historic city of Savannah, Georgia. This year, under the theme Nature, the great cultural achievements of the Western tradition will be studied and the most profound and enduring questions of the human condition addressed. 35 places are available for master's students, and full scholarships will be offered to all successful applicants. Please visit ralston.ac for further details.
We get into the negative time, and part of the purpose of your book is to offer people understanding and even some guidance about how to work in a negative, in a hostile world. We're there. We need help. We need guidance, which you turn to in chapter 3. For evangelicals, you acknowledge it's a, quote, unfamiliar territory for evangelicals in this hostile age. No models from the past for them. The Falwell, no. The sensitivity, no. Where do they look for guidance, apart from your book?
Yeah, no, one of the things that, there's a lot in there. One of the things that I stress in the book is the need to pivot away from these strategies, like not pivot away from, but to rebalance, to change, to shift the emphasis less on sort of being relevant to the culture and the way the seeker sensitivity or cultural engagers, another group I talk about, have less about trying to transform the culture like the culture war people did, and more about being a counterculture, strengthening the strength of the church. And the model that I actually point to is say, look, we're now a moral minority. I think that's very clear. And when you are a minority, you have to adopt the minority mindset, which is very difficult, I think, for American Protestants, because they really represented the mainstream of America for a very long time and basically viewed the mainstream institutions of society as theirs. Minorities can't always do that. And so the actual example I point to is sort of pre-war American Catholicism, because there were a large number of Catholics. So it wasn't like a group like Sikhs or Jews, who are very, very small and tied to a sort of particularized ethnicity. There's a lot of Catholics. They're in a sort of an anti-Catholic culture, I think, still fair to say, at that time, and realize if we want to be faithful Catholics in this Protestant country, we have to create the infrastructure and the institutions that allow us to do this. So they created all the parish schools. They created the Catholic universities, created fraternal organizations, had all of these practices and things that demarcated and sustained community life. And Catholics, even though they were sort of admitted to the mainstream, starting, with the Kennedy election, probably in the 1960s, have never let go of their own infrastructure. And I think the evangelical infrastructure is much less developed. And that
I wanted to ask you about that. You actually refer to a book that Mark Knoll wrote, or a statement he made in 1994, that one of the problems here, precisely on this network side, is that evangelicals simply have not had a deep, this is Knoll's claim, they have no deep tradition of thought, of intellectual rumination, and a group of intellectuals, party thinkers, so to speak.
Well, I think
you think he was right about that?
Yes and no. What I would say is that Protestantism in America sort of had a little bit of a division of labor, or if you want to call it that. So there were, Protestantism was always very socioeconomically, sort of ethnically and racially stratified. And so, if you think about like class, there's this, there's the old quip, so I can't remember all the people, there's variations of this. It's like, the American, average American starts out as the son of a Baptist farmer. He becomes a Methodist when he gets his first white collar job. He becomes a Presbyterian when he gets his first promotion. And when he joins the C-suite, he becomes an Episcopalian. And so there was this sense in which the intellectual elites of Protestantism were very heavily concentrated in these top-end mainline denominations. So there's an incredible legacy of intellectualism in Protestant America, but it was concentrated in the main lines, and then it was concentrated in mainstream institutions like Harvard, Princeton, and Yale, who, really self-consciously thought of themselves as Protestant institutions. A lot of the blowback against William F. Buckley's God and Man at Yale is because, hey, we actually let you, you're this Catholic upstart that we let you come into our university, and then you trash it, okay? You don't understand our values. One guy, I think it was Henry Sloan Coffin, said he should have gone to Fordham instead. Basically, that was their response. And so I think what happened was, as the sort of mainstream institution sort of became secularized, and as the mainline denominations really went into a severe decline, evangelicals sort of were sort of middle class, kind of an on down kind of movement, has not yet developed its own intellectual resources, in a sense. And so I do think that creating that space is very important. And that's one of the things in the book is like, look, we can't, you could go back to the liberal Protestants of the 1950s, and they didn't hold to evangelical theology on things like the virgin birth or the resurrection of Christ and all that, but they basically agreed with the moral system of Christianity, there was very little daylight in terms of morality and ethics between the mainline Protestants and what you would say evangelicals. And, you know, they also had essentially, you know, commitments to truth and things of that nature. And so, you know, you could still look to a liberal Protestant intellectual to basically give you a, you know, something that's going to be semi-aligned with your values. Well, that's not true today. You know, if you're looking at, you know, our universities, for example, they're full of people who just simply deny reality, you know, arguing that, like, no, there really is no biological basis to gender, you know, and it's like, that's, which is ludicrous. You know, and, you know, if they said something like, hey, there are important dimensions of how gender is expressed in every human society, I would agree with that. But like this idea that, like, well, it doesn't really matter. And I read some of these things. I'm like, what is going on with these people?
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of, you know, so you can't really rely on these other intellectuals to get it. And I also argue, you know, you also, you know, evangelicals shouldn't, they've been over reliant on Catholic intellectuals. And I think that Catholic intellectuals are always going to, you know, as it were, smuggle in these essentially Catholic-specific views of the world. And it's not all bad. I think there are a lot of great Catholic intellectuals, but we also, we can't just outsource our thinking. And so we have to develop ways to have our own intellectuals and our own, you know, our own excellences that are, you know, that we have some self-confidence in. And don't have this sort of cultural cringe such that we're, you know, we feel like we're second rate and we're always aspiring to be accepted at Harvard or something like that. We're not going to be accepted at Harvard.
We talked about groups, but you give individual advice as well. One of them is financial frugality that you discuss as sort of individual planning. What's so important about financial frugality? How does that help in this day and age?
Yeah, I give some starter ideas across basically three dimensions, sort of the personal, the institutional, and the missional. So how do we live as individuals and families? How should our churches, ministries, businesses operate? And then how should we do mission? And on the personal front, what I say is I think we need to have a great deal more intentionality about many of the decisions of our lives, weighing what it means to be in this negative world. So where should I live? What career should I go into? What sort of financial posture, you know, should I adopt? Because I think there is more risk today of falling afoul of sort of secular ideologies and finding yourself, you know, in trouble. And you don't have to be a Christian for that to happen to you.
Yeah.
You know, it's very easy to have a you know, a social media mob come after you. And what we see is most of the time, the institutions capitulate and you could lose your job and find yourself essentially cast out into the outer darkness socially. And so if you're, you know, living a, you know, very high debt, high consumption lifestyle in New York City, and you don't have the, you know, family background, you know, except if you're not really equipped to navigate that, that should be in trouble. So I'm not saying, I do talk about these interesting people who are adopting like extreme frugality, or I'll talk about, you know, different people like that. But so I'm not necessarily saying you should adopt a particular posture, but I do think in our world, we should be, you know, reconsidering, we should be very intentional about how we structure our finances. And in a higher risk world, you know, we probably need to have greater buffers and greater margin in various aspects of our life against, you know, bad things happening to us.
Yeah. And I see that in, you know, in students who are on the success track, you know, the achievement track, they got to keep their heads down, right? But the gauntlet is pretty tight now for professional advancement.
Yeah, and what happens is if you're, you know, living life with no margin, then you are not in a position to put yourself out there. You know, once you, if you have achieved, you know, some degree of financial security or freedom, once you've got like a big war chest in the bank and your expenses aren't that high, you know, you can afford to be bolder. You can afford to be bolder in mission, you know, for Christ. You could afford to do something like, oh, become, go into the ministry. in ways you can't. So there are a lot of things that having margin enables you to do, you know, because in our society today, it's really almost Orwellian. You know, I've done a lot of work in urban policy as well. I'll go to a conference and 100% of the people who speak agree on every issue. It's like there's very little fundamental disagreement in anything that you see in sort of our leadership classes today. And there is this sort of like hyper-conformity and, you know, a sense in which you can't speak. If you step out of line, you might get zapped. So everybody's kind of terrorized about doing that. And so what we need to do, and what I seek to do for myself, I don't think everybody has to operate in the way that I do, because I'm sort of out there in public giving views. That's not what most people should be doing. But I want to be able to have a life that allows me to speak truth. Not as a provocateur or a rhetorical bomb thrower, but can actually say, hey, this is truth. And if you don't have a life structured around that, then you can't do it. And so I'm not claiming I'm exactly where I want to be, but that's kind of what I'm working, you know, working towards.
In the chapter entitled Be a Light, you speak of the need for pre-evangelism. We're not, no, evangelism in the negative world. Hold on. We need pre-evangelism. What is that?
Well, it, you know, if you go back to the positive world, you know, and some preacher has a tent revival or a Billy Graham crusade, they sort of could presume that the most of the people in their audience, like, they knew the basics of Christianity. Maybe they were raised in church. They knew the Bible stories. They sort of knew who Jesus was. And they may not have a great understanding of the finer points of theology of, you know, the atonement or something like that. But the basics of Christianity were familiar to them. And many of them probably had in their back of their mind this idea that, you know, there is a God and there is a judgment day, and I probably should be a better person and I probably should be religious. You could sort of preach the gospel to them direct. Well, now you have to deal with the fact that a lot of young people don't know anything about Christianity. They've never read the Bible. They don't know any of the Bible stories. They don't know anything about Jesus. And so you have to somehow build a bridge to be able to get them to a point where, you know, the gospel sort of makes sense to them. And that's very difficult to do. You know, Paul tried to do that, for example, at his speech at Mars Hill, where he tried to talk about the, you know, the religious people. I see all these, you know, religious statues and things. And let me tell you that. Let me tell you about this one. Now, of course, I don't think his mission to Athens was particularly successful. That's a hard environment to go into. And I think we're in kind of that kind of hard environment today. And, you know, so I do think there's this element of we have to, like, educate people somewhat. There's a little extra work you have to do in order to, you know, even explain what the gospel is in ways that make sense. You can't just assume people, you know, went to Sunday school or vacation Bible school when they were a kid.
Yeah. Last question. Aaron, we make healthy communities. They make unhealthy communities. Are they doomed?
Who's
this hyper-secular, negative, the people, the apostles of negative world for us. They're not going to succeed, are they?
Well, I think there is.
How are cities doing today, right? So go ahead.
I think there is a streak of thinking that goes both through political conservatism and in religious conservatism that goes something like this. You know, what can't go on forever eventually will stop. And, you know, reality will impose discipline. People who do these things, it's ultimately going to fail, essentially. Which part of it, I think part of it is that's a nice thing to do, because it means we don't actually have to do anything. We just have to sort of sit back and wait for the system to kind of collapse and for people to come to their senses. And I'm not betting any money that that's going to happen. We have a lot of dysfunctions in America. The truth is we've had worse dysfunctions in America in the past. You know, the urban crisis of the 70s was a heck of a lot worse than what we got today. The Depression was pretty bad. The Civil War was pretty bad. You know, I'm not one of these people who's betting on America collapsing. At the same time, we do see that at the individual level, well, I think the system may be more resilient than we think. Certainly, I wouldn't be structuring my life in the anticipation that it's going to decline. I do think at the individual level, people are really hurting. You know, when you look at the young people and you know, the mental illness, when you look at the people dying of fentanyl, the deaths of despair, you see the declining family formation rates, loneliness epidemics, things of that nature. I think many people who are even very successful are less, you know, less satisfied than they like to publicly advertise. And so I do think that it is incumbent on us, and this is one of the things that I stress in the book, we have to create a counterculture. We have to create an alternative moral economy, moral community, in which, yes, we're oriented first and foremost correctly towards heavenly things, but also that leads to greater flourishing. And, you know, what we're seeing is, instead, the church is becoming a conformed to the world in terms of long-term singleness and things of that nature, and is in fact attempting to reconcile that. In the evangelical world, there's basically tons and tons of material talking about, oh, you can't have the idolatry of the family. Oh, singleness is a great Christian calling. Maybe it's a better Christian calling. And so we're essentially selling out the futures of young people, which I think is disgusting. And instead, we need to be figuring out how to help them achieve things like not falling prey to all of the vices in our society, like porn, gambling, you know, things of that nature. And also to, again, get married, stay married, have a family. You know, we need to have some sort of an alternative moral community. And I think that if we're successful in building that, also becomes something that attracts people, which was the case, you know, in the Roman Empire, that the church was so different.
Yeah.
And, you know, even the pagan, you know, the famous letter from Julian is like, well, we see that these people like take care of their own. We see that they give them proper burial. People can see that these people, these Christians, are better than we are. And that's a problem. We have to get in the game. And so I do think there's a sense in which if we are able to create that, it becomes attractional, that people want to be a part of it. Yeah. But it only happens if you actually have a community that has that. And right now, we're way too little differentiation versus the world at large.
The book is Life in the Negative World, Confronting Challenges in an Anti-Christian Culture. Aaron Wren, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.